If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Today, we're truly blessed. We have with us husband and wife team, Drs. Sam and Mark Bailey. And oh my goodness, they're so wonderful. And they have written a book, another book, called The Final Pandemic. And my copy arrived. And I had my day planned. And I had all these jobs that I had to do that were pressing. And I was going to do them. And I thought, I'll just open this book. I never got up. It's a page turner, Sam. Do I call you Sam?
Yes, please do. Yes.
Sound like you're a gay couple, you know, Mark and Sam.
I know.
And I couldn't stop reading it. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
And everyone should buy one that's interested in the whole COVID scam, and buy another one because you'll surely give it away. Possibly to someone who's on your wavelength, you say this will give you the big picture and the overview and the detail. And you might give it to someone who is a friend but thinks you're nuts and say, here, read this. Is that the sort of way you think of the book, Sam?
Yeah, definitely. This book was something, it wasn't our idea originally. It was something, it came from a friend of ours, Tim Noakes, who's a South African sports scientist. And he read Virus Mania, the first, you know.
Which I've read and it's a great book. Yeah.
Yeah. And he said it's the most wonderful. It converted him to lots of ideas about viruses and the problems with virology. But his criticism was that, and it's not really a criticism, but he said it's quite an imposing book, and because it's so big, it is about over 1,200 references to it. A lot of people will be, you know, intimidated by reading it. There needs to be an easier version of Virus Mania with the punchy, with all the most important parts of it. And I thought, this is a great idea, actually. And then Mark and I started this process of how we could help people to see how a pandemic can be created. And, yeah.
Created. Mark, how do you write a book with your wife?
Well, Rodney, it's funny because Sam started her channel in 2020. And as you know, she used to actually be a mainstream TV presenter here in New Zealand. Yes. Until she started going off their script, and quickly they took her off, quick smart. And but anyway, when Sam started her YouTube channel in early 2020, she was always the face of what we did. And but she had
I
me
can
in
see
the
why.
Yeah, sometimes I come onto these things and Sam's not there and you can see the disappointment. Sam had her channel going in 2020, and it quickly, she started getting so many questions from the audience that she pulled me into it and said, I really need you to research this stuff full time. And given that we were both medical doctors, you know, we were both trained in these fields, we took to it. So we've actually worked together so well since those early days in 2020, with me being chief researcher. If there's a 100-page WHO or CDC document that needs to be read, Sam goes, well, that's your job.
Yeah.
And I spend hours going through it, working out all the scientific details and critiquing it, and then I give a summary to Sam and she works out how to present it to the audience. Because often, Rodney, I find this real technical stuff and I love writing about it. And I show it to Sam and I go, look at this. We've got them, you know, we've got these virologists, we've got these infectious diseases, so-called experts on this. And Sam goes, I know you have, but we need to communicate that to the audience. And how do we do that? And she finds a way to make it easy, to makes it entertaining. And so, yeah, I think we've... The combination of us is actually, it works beautifully. So, no, there's no problems us working together.
So, Mark, you love nothing better than diving into a technical journal that would make most people's eyes water and nod off to sleep, or they'd need to, I'd need to wrap a wet towel around my head and go to a monastery for a month to read. You just love that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, it really started captivating me in early 2020 because, you know, as you know, I got out of medicine in 2016. Mm. I really didn't have belief in the medical system anymore, so left. And I spent 3 or 4 years completely away from it. And then in 2020, with the onset of this bogus pandemic, my interest was piqued. I was thinking, how on earth are they doing this? How are they convincing the world that there's something deadly on the loose, yeah, and that everybody could die?
Yeah.
And yeah. And we started just scratching beneath the surface. We started with the WHO and CDC and Ministry of Health announcements, and we're looking around and said, well, where are the references? Where are the scientific citations for what they're claiming? Most of the time we found they had absolutely none at all.
And then some you found didn't even add up.
Well, that was it, and that's almost 100% of the case when we did dive down into it. And this took us right back to often with, you know, things like viruses and so-called germs. Yeah. It took us back to the 1800s, and we started getting the original publications. Often we had to get translations because, strangely, these so-called foundational studies are not even published in English, and often, you know, they're in German or another language, and we've had people overseas help us translate them to make sure we're getting it accurate. And so that was astounding. That's what we found in 2020, is when you get into the mechanics, into the bowels of virology and germ theory, et cetera, they simply don't have the evidence, and they've bamboozled the public because
it's a stack of cards.
Yeah. Once you expose the foundations, and that's the idea with the new book, The Final Pandemic, is to show people, let's go back to the foundational evidence that this all, if you follow the citations, you follow the evidence all the way back, where does it lead? And just showing the reader how bogus the whole thing has been.
Was that hard for you both, individually and together? Because you've devoted years and years and years to hard study and extremely hard work to enter a system like a monastery sort of thing, you know, like, or martial arts or something. You know, you've gone through, you've ground through, and you've had your mentors, your professors, people you look up to. And then you've gone down this path. And can I say, rejected it or suggested to them that a big chunk of what they're doing is wrong, that they're misled or mistaken or willfully blind or whatever. And you knew when you stepped over that Rubicon, crossed that stream, no way back. Was that hard?
Yeah, well, I'll say first, because I know Mark will have his own opinion on it. But when in 2020, right, this is when this all went down, Mark's always been my canary in the coal mine. He always is ahead of the curve for me, and he'll be introducing ideas first. And it was Mark that first said to me, he goes, Sam, you need to sit down. I know this is going to sound crazy, but I'm not sure that viruses exist. And I remember my initial reaction to this, because I trust and love Mark, and I always listen because I know that there's something to it, whatever Mark says, because he's researched it usually before he'll say something to me. And when he did, I thought initially it was that just flood of questions that I had. Well, how do you explain antibodies? And tell me, what are you talking about? What about the immune system? And da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it was such a crazy sort of thought process to try and unravel. But a lot of that had already happened in 2020, where you felt like the rug had been pulled under from you, where all these things that you once believed were true, you didn't know where the foundation was anymore. Like, you had to start looking into everything. So in some ways it wasn't too bad because so many, like climate change and I don't know, all these different other areas.
Yes, already. Because once you saw them lying over one thing, you think, ah, well, what a, where do the lies end and where does the truth start? And what your book does for me, scarily, to be honest, is everything was a lie.
Exactly. And it is a horrible thing to come, I think. I was open
to it. Harder for you, right?
I was open to it because I think it's, it was because it was coming from Mark, really. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to look into this myself as well. And but I never had, I think one of the issues is that some people, the dogma cannot be questioned at all. Like, and both of us are very, I think, open-minded in terms of when we hear something, we won't outright dismiss it. We'll go, okay, we're going to look into it ourselves and make up our own minds. So it was, but what I didn't see, Rodney, was that I didn't expect what was going to happen to me eventually, like later on in 2020, because this is earlier on, right? Mm. I thought, okay, oh my gosh, this is all a lie. Let's start talking about these things and videos and things. And then I didn't see, no, you're going to be, your life is going to be fully turned upside down. You're going to be, your medicine is gone, is over now for you. I didn't see that happening. And I don't know why, but at the time it didn't occur to me.
We're naive. I remember having a similar thing in the environmental movement and in environmental department when I realized that the free market would deliver for the environment better than central planning. And I thought everyone would just fall down amazed when I explained it to them. Instead, I was excommunicated. And I was thinking, oh, I just didn't explain that well enough. I'll have another go, you know, because it's so exciting because, you know, this is the truth, right? If you have private property, people will look after it and you have prices and resources will get conserved. Yes, there might be some problems, but we can fix that with a bit of regulation. And overall, the market's a wonderful thing at conserving and looking after resources. And plus, it has freedom and prosperity attached to it too, which are quite cool. No. Because it was... But you see, I never expected that to be the same thing in medicine or, you know. And then climate change, I was on the ground floor of. And again, I didn't expect to see it in medicine, right? And it's just this whole thing. Mark, how was it for you?
Rodney, I loved every moment of it because...
Are you a contrarian, really? You're the guy in the tribe. You know, we're living in a cave and there's a chief that consults the goat's entrails and decides what he's going to do tomorrow. And we're all going to do something. And you're the person in the tribe says, hang on. Is that you? You like being the contrarian. You're the guy that sort of stands up to the false idols and questions them.
Well, one thing you might be interested in, Rodney, was that we don't vote. We're anarchists.
Neither.
And yeah,
neither.
We don't have any faith in political systems. We don't believe.
You're an anarchist.
Yeah.
You're like me.
Yeah. And, you know, people often don't understand what that word means.
No.
But we just don't want... compulsory quote leaders. We don't want compulsory monopolies of violence where we're told that we sign some sort of social contract which we've never seen before.
Yeah.
But anyway, something that might interest you was that when I did vote, it was for the ACT Party when you were involved.
And oh, nice.
I was pretty young at the time and none of my contemporaries would, because ACT was considered this extremo party. And, you know, and of course, these days we don't vote at all. We don't believe in it at all. But that was my starting point. So the first time I ever went to the voting booth, I was 18 years old, and ACT was the only one that made any remote kind of sense to me. So I've always been in that libertarian mindset. And when I went down this pathway, now for me there was I always had a very uneasy relationship with medicine, and I had a bit of a crisis at about the time of graduation, and I thought something feels really, really wrong. And I'd seen things, like, this is around the time I'm also working my first job in a psychiatric institution. I'm witnessing things like electroconvulsive treatments, in quotes. I'm witnessing chemical restraint, physical restraint. And then moving into surgical wards and witnessing all sorts of procedures on people who are clearly going to die. And it's just absolutely horrendous, you know, what they were putting these poor souls through. And just really not, I didn't believe in it, to be honest. And I worked with colleagues that seemed to think it was, you know, incredible what we were doing, that we were operating at the highest levels that the science had taken us to. And I just didn't see it. I thought this is, it's an aberration.
Interesting.
It's an aberration of health. I once said to a group of doctors when I was in the hospital, I said, because they were all talking about evidence-based this and evidence-based that, and I put it out there and I said, where's the evidence that this huge building we're working in with 400 beds, where's the evidence that that's any good for our community? And oh, the outrage. They said, how could you ask such a question? And I said, well, I don't see any evidence. There's no one's conducted a study to look into whether this is useful or not. I said, the only way to do it would be to split the city into two. Half of the city has access to all the bells and whistles and scanners and tests and pharmaceuticals and procedures, and the other half doesn't, and see what happens. And I mean, a couple of the doctors there got it, and they said, no, I agree that we don't have evidence that this is good for the community. But I guess, you know, for most of them, it makes it feel like something good is happening. It feels like the doctors know what they're doing, etc. So now, I've always been interested in where the evidence actually lies. So, you know, I left medicine in 2016, and I had no intention of getting involved with it ever again.
It's astonishing when you put it like that, that this goes on and each person plays here. We all play our little part in a psychodrama sort of thing, don't we? And for most of us, we played along with medicine, at least, until we hit the COVID. And some of us, that shook us awake from our slumbers, so to speak. You strike me, Mark, as quite an intense guy, very deep-thinking guy, and also not too socialized in a sense. When I say that, you don't need people's concurrence with what you're thinking or doing. You are happy to go your own way.
Yep, absolutely. And it's funny, Rodney, because with friends and neighbours, we're incredibly social people. And
yes,
a lot of people that we interact with, they don't even know what we do. I think some of our neighbours are like that. I mean, we get along famously, and yet they're vaguely aware of that we might have been doctors. But, you know, I don't think they haven't read our publications or wouldn't understand the, you know, what we've...
Isn't that great?
Yeah. And you're right. I don't, when I publish something, I don't compromise. I don't think, well, this could offend someone. Or when I publish, say, A Farewell to Virology in 2022, I reread it after I'd finished it and thought, well, this basically rips the guts out of virology. It points out that the whole thing's been a pseudoscience, that they... Ooh. They tried to come up with a model. It's completely failed. And I thought, I wonder how many hundreds of thousands of people are employed in this industry and happily going along with it, or actually truly believing that what they're doing is useful or contributing to humanity. And
I'm going to get to that.
Yeah, but for me, I thought, I have to communicate to the public exactly what's happened here, because getting to the facts is far more important than thinking about whose careers might be affected or
offending people.
Yeah. So no, and I think, you know, obviously that's why various groups, including these government institutions and the international media, have come after us, because we're not just looking into some minor points or having a few minor disagreements here. we're saying that the entire foundation to huge sections of allopathic medicine are built on fraud, and yes, in many cases, knowingly so. Yeah. We're not saying that the lower level participants, like the doctors and nurses, etc., they probably are completely unaware of what's going on, but certainly at higher levels, this has been, you know, engineered and brought about. So, yeah, when it comes to that, I have no qualms about publishing exactly what we've found.
And opening it up for critique.
Totally. And that's what we amazingly don't understand. Do you know, in some ways, Rodney, like you coming up with the solution for environmental issues, we were the same in 2020. We thought halfway through 2020,
this is all over.
We thought, oh my goodness, the whole thing's going to be shut down because we've Sam come and I up with this. Have done the research and now we're going to present it. And as soon as people see it, they'll say,
oh yeah,
thank you very much for bringing this to our attention.
Yeah.
And it was sort of funny because we honestly said that the whole COVID thing will be over by December 2020. That's what we predicted in early and mid 2020. Because Sam and I could see how farcical it was.
I am guilty of that at every turn. I remember going to a conference in 1992 in the States on climate change. It was global warming. And it was 3 days of debunking the stupidity of it. This is 1992. And there were these esteemed professors who that was their career, was meteorology, atmospheric physics, and the whole thing, history of climate. And 3 days of just mind-blowing, how stupid are these people pretending to do science with models? And I remember driving back with a professor from Utah and turning to him and saying, well, I think that's global warming over with. And he said, I don't know, so I think this thing might have leaks. And I just can't believe it, right? Because that's another example. Just it's a whole life I've seen this stuff, you know, like no matter where you go on it, it's wrong. This thing on virology. I remember I'm a great follower of the Weston A. Price nutrition, and the Weston A. Price people I thought were wrong because they said, you know, vaccines are bad. And I thought, no, it can't be, surely not. But I read about it. And again, I said, surely not. But I remember reading a skeptic's book of virology. I can't remember who it was, but it went right back to the start with Louis Pasteur, and I've got a name in my mind, Beauchamp. And as I read it in this one book I read, Beauchamp was the true scientist, and Pasteur was a fraudster who just had played politics and had the ear of the politicians and was presenting himself as this great scientist, when the man who was actually doing the science, and Pasteur was cribbing off, but cribbed poorly, just went on and did the science. And it was the politician scientist that won out, like we have with climate change, because he had the ear of the rich and powerful. So it's not like this thing was got off to a bad start. It goes all the way back. And Beauchamp's point was, it's the state of the body that causes the disease. It's the terrain, and he had the French phrase. Is that, am I correct in that, my memory of reading that book?
Yeah, definitely. And it's the idea of terrain theory versus germ theory. So germ theory is the Pasteur type model where you have one germ causes one disease, and usually yes, there's one treatment for it, and often it's a vaccine, maybe antibiotics or something else. And then you've got the terrain theory, which is the idea that everything's in balance, the microbes aren't there to harm you, that your terrain, like a plant, if the plant doesn't get enough sunshine, if it gets too much water, too much wind, the plant will get sick, and the microbes come in there to help clean up. Usually it's like fungus, their job is to start eating away dead tissue. They're not there to hurt us. And so if you control and look after your terrain, then you'll be well. And
yeah, and I think we should point out, Rodney, the obvious difference between the two here from a commercial point of view. You can see with germ theory, as Sam mentioned, it ends with one product, whether yes. that's an antibiotic, a vaccine, or some sort of pharmaceutical. The terrain model doesn't end with a product because the person is now well. They don't have need for anything. They're back to normal. So you can see instantly from a commercial point of view which one is going to be attractive to industry. And there's no doubt that in the early days, late 1800s, moving into the early 1900s, the nascent pharmaceutical industry looked at those two models and said, well, the germ one's going to serve us incredibly well. The other model, the terrain, that's of no use whatsoever because there's no money to be made in it. Once people know how to be healthy, you can't sell them anything anymore.
It's hard to make money telling people to exercise and eat good food and enjoy sunshine.
Yeah. Rodney, if we get asked to provide a consultation for someone, we say to them, did you not listen to what we just said?
Yes.
We most of our information each week we put out free. We just release it to the world in presentation. And we show people why they don't need doctors for virtually anything. We're not talking about car accidents or acute kind of crises that some people can get into, because there can be life-saving manoeuvres that surgeons can do, et cetera, or broken bones, et cetera, which need to be reset. There's nothing wrong with that side of things. But, you know, for the vast majority of problems, there is absolutely no need to engage with the medical system. There's no need to register your children with the medical centre. There's no need to put them on a vaccination register, all the sort of stuff, screening programs. We show people this is all a complete waste of time. It doesn't serve your health and your family's well-being. It serves an industry. And again, we'll point out, because, you know, some people might be listening, nurses and doctors, et cetera, thinking, I'm trying to help people and stuff. But the problem is that they're working within a false paradigm. These models have been completely refuted. They're completely wrong.
And, of course, like climate change, like fast food, like Kellogg's and Sanitarium, big, big money, the biggest money ever in the pharmaceutical industry. And you go to your doctor for a 10-minute consultation, you're a bit grumpy if you don't get a prescription and a bottle of pills to make you better at the end of it. It's absurd, isn't it?
That's what we focus on, yeah, is telling people that.
Teaching people how to be well.
Yeah, and almost, Rodney, we point out the irony that, you know, what they're trying to present, you know, organisations, whether they're the New Zealand Ministry of Health or the CDC in the United States, the WHO, they're saying, well, you know, it's all very well with thinking about exercising and eating the best foods and drinking pure water and having a healthy marriage and raising healthy kids, etc. That's all very well. But what we need to focus on is invisible particles in the air that are going to kill you. And if you come in and take our prescriptions and do our tests, that's the pathway to health. I mean, it's so preposterous when you can see what this is, that they constantly put out these fear narratives. And they are bringing people into a paradigm which, you know, as we point out in the book, it's not only damaging for health. I mean, this ends up killing people. People who would have otherwise been perfectly well, would have lived a healthy life, are being brought into this allopathic system, these false paradigms. They're being given products. And even sometimes worse, it's just the fear narratives. Yes. And we've spent, you know, 4 years trying to point out to people, don't buy into these fear narratives that your children are going to die if they don't get vaccinated, or that there's, you know, new viruses are jumping out of the jungle every 5 minutes and the next one might kill us all. These absolute silly fear narratives. And so what we do, obviously, is strip it back and show the foundational science and show how this has all been misrepresented. There's no evidence of it whatsoever.
I've probably read a dozen books now on the COVID pandemic and overviews. I find it remarkable that the best book written is a Kiwi book. Isn't that, it's amazing. You're sort of like overseas. This, I mean, and it's beautifully written, extremely, it's just a wonderful book. Now, I want to take you to the book because I so love the book. I just, you got to, listeners, trust me on this. You will not be disappointed. How do the people buy the book, by the way?
Yeah, so just a caveat with this too, so that you can either, there's two ways, through Amazon or Lulu. Lulu is an independent bookstore if you don't want to support Amazon, I get that. Okay. One of the caveats is because the last few books we've done has been a lot of work because we've ended up distributing it ourselves.
Yeah, within New Zealand.
Within New Zealand, yeah. And we decided we can't do it this time just because of the time involved. And unfortunately, the shipping is more expensive, so I'm sorry just in advance. But it was so we could self-publish. We've done it all ourselves. And so it's available on Amazon or Lulu Bookstore.
And, coming to Sam's website, so drsambailey.com and look up the final pandemic and that'll have the options there. And of course, people in New Zealand can get the ebook. There's no extra charge for that. And that's like instantly available to them.
Yeah. Tell me, did you have any trouble getting it on Lulu and Amazon?
No, it's been okay for both actually. Lulu's is really good because I like it because it's kind of more independent and it's in kind of competition with Amazon.
Yeah.
But they were okay. What I have found previously with books like Virus Mania is that it's other kind of, you know, secondary groups that are really difficult to get on, like, or the book will be available. Like, I think the Book Depository had Virus Mania and then it suddenly, without warning, would just take it away. And like Kobo books, some things like that were strange. I thought, where has this come from? And you could write to them and say, why is the book, was it available? Now it's not. That may happen. But
so far, so good.
So far.
Amazon's usually pretty tolerant of most material. So we haven't found censorship from that. As Sam said, we've had a couple of other publishing houses suddenly take it off. Like Sam's got audiobooks for Virus Mania as well. That's been taken off. So, and they'll sell it for 3 months and then you'll get some vague email saying this has breached some sort of guidelines, and they don't tell us, they don't point out which sentence or which fact is being contested.
Well, it's like that's when you know in an open society, that's when you know you're hitting home, because there's no refutation. There's just censorship and scoffing and personal attack. So there's no attempt to critique a work of scholarship. It's just, we can't have this. Or these doctors are spreading misinformation, or this person's a terrible person, or they're grifters, or whatever. And that's, if there was an argument, they would deliver it. But there isn't. But let me go to the book. I tell you why I love the book too, because it's a great history of the pandemic in of itself, but you see this history through a framework of understanding of principles of biology and medicine and wrong think. But the history alone is worthwhile because you have this wonderful part where you take us to those images coming out of China. And it's hard to believe now, isn't it? But they had TV pictures broadcast around the world of men dropping dead in the street with their shopping. Isn't that extraordinary?
I think you can only look at it now in hindsight, though, can't you? Like, at the time, it's like, oh my gosh, this is real. There's just, you're bombarded with all this information.
Oh, he's walking down the street. He's got his groceries. Oops, he died. And then Chinese guys in hazmat suits, right, come running up in this crazy vehicle and scoop him up.
Yeah.
And this was presented as news. And there's no one saying, hang on, no disease is operated like that ever. You know, walk along with your groceries and then drop dead and people come along in a hazmat suit. But that was played and played and played. And the reason I wasn't affected is I don't watch TV. But I did watch TV one night and I was so shocked by it. I could understand it was sort of like, it was like a Hollywood blockbuster, or it was like that movie Wag the Dog. It was like it's being put together to drive this incredible fear. So, in the benefit of hindsight, and even then, if you had, you know, half a questioning mind, you say this is horse manure, right? But then you say, well, where do the lies start and end? And this is where it gets interesting, and I want to go through this book. You got to buy several copies. It is just so wonderful. But Timothy Noakes writes a great overview forward to this book. And I've seen this before, but I just want to walk us through it, because this to me is damning. This is the first days of COVID. Can I do that with you, Sam and Mark?
Yes.
Day one, the 30th of December, 2019. An eye doctor in China spots a case of supposedly atypical pneumonia. That's the start of the pandemic. Day seven, this is the 5th of January, the World Health Organization announces that they have identified 44 cases of atypical pneumonia of unknown etiology. Have I got that word right?
Yeah, cause, yeah.
Etiology.
Etiology, yeah.
Why don't they say unknown cause?
Yeah.
In a specific population of 8 million people in China. So 44 cases of some sort of pneumonia. We don't know what's causing it. Day nine, the 7th of January, the WHO announces that this atypical pneumonia is caused by a SARS-like virus. Picture this. In 2 days, it's gone from 44 cases of pneumonia that's not usual to a pneumonia that's been caused by a particular type of virus. That's impossible, right? We get to day 12, 10th of January. The firm manufacturing the first COVID-19 PCR tests starts shipping them. Like, this is true, right?
Yes.
We've gone from an eye doctor in China spotting a case of supposedly atypical pneumonia, and 12 days later, they're shipping a PCR test for it. On day 14, the 12th of January, the WHO accepts Professor Christian Drosten's PCR testing protocol as, quote, the gold standard for the testing for this novel disease. There clearly wasn't any testing, any looking at this, any questioning what the hell is going on, how does this test work? Nope. So we've gone from one case on the 30th of December to day 12, a test is being shipped, and on day 14, that test has become the gold standard. We get to day 23. The PCR testing protocol is submitted for review to an international scientific publication. This is 3 weeks after the first supposed eye doctor finding an atypical case. They've now got it in, this testing protocol for it. Day 25, that paper for testing the protocol is accepted for publication and is published within 27 hours in a journal of which Drosten is an editor.
No, no problems there.
No peer review, no critique, nothing. Day 26, a paper describing the clinical features of COVID-19 is published by Chinese scientists in The Lancet. And then we get to day 32, the first letter describing asymptomatic transmission of COVID-19 is published in the New England Journal of Medicine. That alone is shocking. It's you just need to say that and the game should be up, right?
Yeah, and Rodney, it's actually even worse.
Because, oh, God.
Yeah, because, you know, when they say things like that they'd found atypical pneumonia, that's just misleading the public completely, because this is what happened in early 2020. Sam and I looked up the clinical, you know, details of these supposed atypical pneumonia cases. They were no different than all of the other atypical type pneumonias, because atypical pneumonia is a term used in medicine. It's just used to say, oh, the pneumonia is a little bit different.
It's a bit unusual.
A bit unusual than the typical pneumonia presentation. It doesn't mean that it's a new disease or a new type of, quote, pathogen has been, you know, encountered. None of that whatsoever. So we look back to those original cases that were described, and they have fever and cough, shortness of breath, some changes on x-rays or
CT. Very typical.
This is pneumonia.
Yeah.
And in places like Wuhan, pneumonia is incredibly common, far, far more common than in places like New Zealand. They have incredibly poor air quality.
It's polluted.
The cities are polluted. I mean, it's a major, major problem in China is pneumonia. So there was nothing special about those cases whatsoever.
And what is an eye doctor seeing a pneumonia case, by the way? They don't care about pneumonia. Well, you hear about eyes.
I mean, well, as you know, Rodney, it got even crazier because that eye doctor subsequently apparently died. And he was 33 years old. And as we point out, this was the bait and switch. Like you say, they're telling us people are walking down the street and dropping dead. And 33-year-old doctors, previously fit and well, they're dying as well because they're encountering this so-called virus, you know. And that's why we put those images in the book, because I think at the time, most people around the world, even the more skeptical, were absolutely terrified when they saw those pictures.
Yes.
There appeared to be people dead on the street. There appeared to be a 33-year-old doctor, you know, an intensive care unit dying. There appeared to be, you know, the other thing they introduced, obviously, was the so-called lab leak theory. They had these maps of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. All of these things were being introduced in the first few months of 2020. And that's what we wanted to do, as you say, was go back over the history and say, look at what they were saying in the headlines. Look at these pictures, and we'll show you what actually happened with the underlying scientific publications and also the rollout of the PCR, etc. And I can see it on your face that you get it because you're laughing. It's so preposterous.
And so preposterous.
That's what we want to show people, that this is not just a fraud, COVID-19. It's a complete fraud.
Mm.
There was no basis to the entire thing. They simply rolled out a PCR that had no ability to diagnose anything. It just was picking up genetic sequences, which they'd pre-selected. And there was a marketing campaign like we've never seen of telling people that you've got to lock down, you've got to get ready for the worst pandemic in human history. And let's face it, 95% of the world took it hook, line and sinker. I don't think so many people, you know, have fallen for it now. But at the time, those fear campaigns were effective.
The other thing, by the way, your book is great because it's not a polemic. It's well written and clear and written with some passion and verve. But the facts, it doesn't need any polemical rhetoric. It's just telling the story when you see it from go to woe. It is just so compelling as to what has gone on here. This idea, you know, this test and then the vaccine, right? It's just extraordinary. Now, tell me, you do a great job in the book also of how the ground, and I don't know whether this is a conspiracy, it's just a coalition of interests collide and craziness and human condition. But the ground was well tilled by Hollywood. Because we'd all seen Hollywood stories, and you describe one called Outbreak, right? Which was a 1995 movie. Good movie, right? The bloody movie is what happened. It's like we'd all seen the movie. But we've seen movies and shows and read books about, you know, a germ coming from outer space or a germ jumping from a bat, you know, to a human and threatening all of human civilization. Everyone walking around in these movies in hazmat suits and people are dying left, right and center. It's a genre of movie, right? And those movies serve to precondition us to the possibility.
Absolutely.
And people around us felt themselves expert on this because they'd seen a movie. It's just in their mind, right? It was fertile ground. And we'd also had that story of the Spanish flu, you know? Oh, ripped through and killed all these people. And this is even worse, you know, 100 times worse, or Ebola or AIDS. This has all been happening in the background, building up to this crescendo. And you do a great job at laying, if you like, the cultural background to why we would fall for this. Because I would suggest to you that if it was the 1950s, wouldn't have worked. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah, and even going, I think a really interesting one that our friend Eric Coppolino brought up was about the Hong Kong flu that happened at the time of the Woodstock Festival.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that. I'm old enough.
Was, yeah, there was like 100,000 people dying from the Hong Kong flu.
Supposedly,
you know.
Yeah.
And the Woodstock Festival went ahead, no problems.
And people that were there, Rodney, said that definitely they didn't see any face masks or social distancing going on. In fact, it was sort of the opposite. It was a bit of a free-for-all.
Yeah, there wasn't even condoms, yeah.
No. And people weren't too worried about passing around the so-called germ. And you think, like you say, so despite the fact that it was being reported on the news that there was this Hong Kong influenza pandemic going on, people around the world were just carrying on as normal. So, but another thing, yeah, that why we put that in the book and particularly gave the example of Outbreak, the 1995 film, was there were a number of things which happened around that time, and we put a few Easter eggs in the references and notes section, and one of them relates to this word zoonotic, which means diseases coming from animals, you know,
into humans
via germs. Now, zoonotic was not a word that was really used much at all in the, you know, post 1950s kind of era, until we get to the mid-90s, and suddenly the word zoonotic starts appearing, you know, 1,000 times more often And you think, what happened in the 1990s? And it was those pandemic movies like Outbreak, which got this word zoonotic out there. And now, honestly, people believe, well, the CDC claims that there are all these diseases coming from animals. And it's because, you know, we mix with animals, apparently.
And on a greater scale than ever.
Well, we point out this is just ridiculous. I mean, we've been mixing with animals for centuries. Yeah. That's nothing new. And in countries like New Zealand, we're not exactly sitting here going, oh, yeah, all of those sheep and cows, they keep making us sick. I mean, and you know, our cats and dogs. It's so stupid. It's so,
but so crazy.
And you'll love this one, Rodney, is that not only are the germs jumping out of the jungle, but you know what's precipitated that? Climate change is what they're saying. So now we're getting two narratives involved and people are, but I mean, the disappointing thing is you talk to some young people, you know, teenagers or people in their early 20s, and they've bought this stuff hook, line and sinker. And they think that the reason we're having pandemics is because, you know, there's man-made climate change and that's caused the animals to change their behaviour. And then that's caused germs to come out of the jungle. I mean, this is honestly
one thing after the next.
So silly. And that's what we point out in the book is to say, let's actually examine the scientific papers they are presenting to back this up. And people can just see, as you say, we just show them what was published in the scientific material. And if people think that that's real, there's not much we can do. I mean, it's so silly, this stuff.
But it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because it's very hard to shake a belief that you've held your whole life. And you've got that belief on the flimsiest of reasons. It could be a movie or a headline or someone said once. But we've all had this experience. We're very clever and well-read and educated people just get such umbrage. And yet they themselves have never done any inquiry into it, right? And basically I find after a while of huffing and puffing, they say, oh, well, you're saying to me now that you're like, you know more than a virologist. And they just defer to an expert. And what we're saying is, no, I'm not saying I know more than a virologist. I just got these questions and that this is absurd. It's just like, this is absurd that sequence of days is absurd. And that's why you struggle, because particularly Dr. Mark Bailey is sitting there saying, criticize me where I'm wrong. And it doesn't happen, but you're just wrong. You're wrong because you're shaking a belief system and money. You go on about other viruses, right, and other pandemics. AIDS was a great one, wasn't it?
Yeah, now, I mean, that's covered extensively in Sam's other book, Virus Mania. And in the final pandemic, we just present it a bit more concisely.
You should buy both books, listeners, because you're going to read the first one and want to get into the second one. By the way, I'll give you the context for this book. I thought Robert Kennedy's book on Fauci was brilliant, and I loved it. This book is better. And there'll be a lot of people listening who have read Fauci's book and said it was great and given it to people. And it's very easy to think that because someone's in New Zealand writing away that they're not presenting, oh, it's just, you know, a couple of Kiwis. It's not a presidential candidate and a Kennedy. But to me, this book was way better in explaining to me what had gone on. You got chapter 3 there, which is a history of misplaced beliefs. And this is the nub of it to me, because it's a misplaced belief that we have that I'm running around healthy, and then a little germ jumps from a monkey onto me. or someone goes past me and a germ lands up my nose and I get sick. And that's how I catch disease. I catch a disease. And the telling one for me was, when you had this idea of catching a cold. I love this story because this brought back a memory. Because my mother, bless her soul, would always be saying to me when I was a little boy, put your coat on or you'll catch your death of cold. You'll catch a cold. Get out of those wet clothes or you'll catch a cold. Her concept of me catching a cold was actually getting wet and cold. Now we say, stay away from Sammy. You'll catch a cold off him. All right? It's a same set of words, but a completely different concept of how you catch a cold. Doesn't that summarize what you're saying in those in that change of that phrase?
Yeah, and you'll notice in the book too and in our other writings and presentations that Sam and I take a particular interest in the definition of words and the etymology as well. And a lot of these words have been changed over time. So like you say, things like catch a cold did not initially refer to anything to do with germs or catching it from another person. It simply meant that if you exposed yourself to various conditions, such as, you know, getting too cold or wet outside, that you might catch this condition. And also words like contagion, which have been changed completely. So these days, when people say contagion in science, it refers specifically to the transmission of disease via germs. But that's not the origins of the word. You know, hundreds of years ago, it simply meant to come into contact with something harmful. And that's really interesting because
it's now just a disease.
They didn't say that it was coming into contact with a harmful germ. Like coming into something, contact with something harmful, that could be an idea. Like coming into contact with a toxic person or a bad idea could actually have negative effects. So same with the word infection. Like we're so far down into this now that Sam and I don't really use the word infection like the mainstream does, because infection stems from the Latin infecere, which means to stain, to ruin. So initially when pathologists were looking at tissue, human tissue, animal tissue, plant tissue, they said that the tissue has been damaged. They didn't say that bugs have got in there and germs are destroying the tissue. They just said it's been spoiled. So all of these words, which people are so sure that they know what they mean, have been changed. And as you know, one of the most, and I talked to you, I was actually just thinking back, Rodney, to the first time I talked on air with you. And I think that got you fired a few days later, because were talking about something that the virologists don't like to talk about, which is the word isolation. Mm. What does isolation mean, you know?
Yeah.
And in virology, it means something completely different than what the public thinks it means. It doesn't
this
mean...
Is a, this, I got to tell you, that shocked me in this book. I was reading that and shaking my head, because I remember from high school Koch's postulates. Is that the right word?
Yeah, Koch's postulates. Yeah.
And it was this idea. Correct me where I'm going wrong. I'm reaching back to my fourth form biology class, where Robert Koch explained that in order to link a disease to a germ, you have to observe the germ everywhere you see the disease, in the cow or the person. And you can't see the germ where you don't see the disease. And then you have to isolate the germ. That is to say, like, get the bacteria or the amoeba. And then you have to infect it into a cow or a person, and they too develop the disease. And that's demonstrating that, yes, I have this germ, and yes, it causes that disease. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, yeah. And initially it was developed just for bacteria and microbes that you could actually see.
Now, viruses are funny things because all they are is a fragment of RNA with a protein sheath, right? Isn't it funny? We see these pictures on front of magazines and in papers, and they have a head and all the rest of it like it's a big thing. That's all it is. It's just a molecule. It's not alive or dead. It's not alive. Tell us about how they isolate this virus.
Yeah. Well, just to clarify, Rodney, they say that some viruses contain DNA. So they can
true.
Be RNA. The most famous one in the world now, SARS-CoV-2, that supposedly contains RNA, but some of the other, quote, viruses, they say contain DNA. But this is the problem, was that the germ theorists, you know, initially they found bacteria and they thought that bacteria caused disease. Now it doesn't. It's associated with disease or some condition. Koch never established the postulates in the first place, and this is what shocked us. We went back and got his pivotal paper that involved Mycobacterium, tuberculosis, and guinea pigs.
TB.
He didn't show that it was a contagious entity. He just showed that if you had guinea pigs under the same conditions in cages for a few months, they'd start getting what we know as TB. It didn't show that it was transmitting between them. It just showed that if they had common environmental conditions, the animals would get sick. So the whole thing with Koch's postulates was that it was never established. And we know all of the excuses, like if there are people listening who go, oh, no, but Rivers' postulates and Molecular's postulates, and yet we've looked into all of those and made rebuttals and responses. But with viruses, it's even worse, because in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they thought, well, there seems to be a lot of cases where we can't actually see any microbes under the microscope, no bacteria, no fungal cells, etc. So there must be something even smaller, an even smaller microbe. This was their idea. And this is a crucial point in the entire history of virology, because people seem to think that they found viruses and then they started investigating them. No, they imagined that there was viruses and then they set about trying to find them, but they never found them.
Because they had to imagine them. Because they had diseases without germs.
They couldn't see that maybe there was other reasons why you got sick. Mm. They thought it has to be.
And just for a slow person like me, what you're saying with the germs that they were seeing, they could well have been a symptom of the disease.
Yeah.
Or part of the cure for the disease that the body's doing.
Yeah,
we often call it the cleanup crew or the firemen. Yeah. You know, you see a house burning down, you don't blame the firemen just because they're there and trying to address the issue. And we use that analogy for, you know, disease, basically.
And the germ theory for disease is relatively recent in terms of the history of medicine, and probably is largely seen as the start of, quote, modern medicine, because you have a single cause for a disease for which there can be medication and ultimately a vaccine. I'm getting this now. Okay.
Yeah.
So then they have people getting sick, but they can't find a microbe. So they say, is it possible, or there must be, microbes smaller that our microscopes can't pick them up? That's where you got to. I interrupted. I'm sorry. I just wanted to walk myself through that. You got to play to the slowest person in this threesome, and it's me, I'm afraid, but I'm there. Okay.
And so then we hit the 1930s, and up until this point, it's all just they're imagining there must be these particles present, etc. 1930s sees the introduction of the electron microscope. So now we're going down and seeing things far, far smaller than the light microscope.
They're extremely powerful microscopes.
So now we're down to the nanoscale now in terms of what can be seen. Now, the first thing that goes wrong for them, Rodney, is that they take tissue from people who they say have viral diseases, like measles, etc., and they get excited and they put the tissue under the microscope thinking that they are going to see all these viruses, and they don't see any. The tissue is not different from conditions that they say are not viral. They don't see these imaginary particles at all. So that was a bit of a problem for them. And then we get to the 1950s, which is the modern, quote, isolation technique of these so-called viruses. And this is an indirect technique where they say, well, you can't find the viruses in the snot or in the stool or on the skin. You can't find it anywhere. Basically, they go looking with human tissue or animal tissue. So what they say is that we'll mix the human specimen with the cell culture. And they like to use things like monkey kidney cells, abnormal monkey kidney cells, because they have a propensity to react when you expose them to various things in a test tube.
And they tried lots of different cells as well. They really had to work for it to find certain ones that work.
Yeah, because if you use a kind of healthy, normal cell,
it doesn't work.
The viruses don't seem to appear. Mm. So you're better off, they found, getting chromosomally abnormal cells. So they traditionally use these ones which have chromosomal abnormalities, or they're cancer cells, basically. And then they expose them to the human sample and a whole lot of other things. You know, we
antibiotics.
Gone over this many times. They add chemicals and other sources of contamination. And then they say, by doing a few stressful things, they passage the cells, you know, which is taking away their nutrients, etc. And then the cells start breaking down. And when they break down, they form little vesicles as the cell breaks apart. And what the virologists have claimed is that they are the viruses, that they've finally got them to come out. And it's absolutely preposterous, because we're saying, how can you call this isolation when all you've done is add more and more material to the sample and then keep doing things to it until these particles appear, and then you claim that they're the viruses? Now, they have a major problem here, because a virus is supposed to be an infectious disease, you know, causing particle. But they don't have any experiments that show these things do any of that whatsoever, because the times that they've tried to purify these particles and get them by themselves, they either can't do it, in which case they can't claim any scientific knowledge from it, or when they do, there's no difference, you know, exposing animals to these mixtures than if you just do it with a similar mixture they say don't have viruses in. So they've got this roundabout system they've developed. So coming back to your question about how they, quote, isolate, quote, viruses, I mean, this is how they do it. This is the typical procedure. Sorry?
To this day.
Yes.
That was the name.
Now, they've developed other techniques, Rodney, and I think, you know, we point this out in the book, that you don't need to be a scientist to understand that taking biological muck from a bat's intestines and claiming that it has a virus in there because you inject the muck into a one-day-old baby rat's brain and it kills it, that's not evidence of a virus. I mean, that's evidence of, you know, an inhumane procedure. And, you know, this is what they call isolation. We, with Ebola, they say that they isolated this, you know, back in the 70s and 80s by taking a blood sample from a sick person and injecting it straight into a guinea pig and then declaring, we've just isolated the virus because the guinea pig's sick now. And we're like, what? This is, that's
what
not,
is this?
That's not the definition of isolating.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we get all these
people. No, I imagine when you, well, the concept I have of isolating is that you have a file of pure virus, maybe in a crystal form.
Yeah. So, exactly. And we get this from, you know, there's people in the freedom community, like you probably know Steve Kirsch. And Steve Kirsch has made smear articles about us saying, oh, you don't know what you're talking about because you can buy the virus from ATCC, which is this organization which sells these things. And he says that it's in the vial, you know, but we're saying there's nothing in the vial but monkey kidney soup. That's all they have. They claim that there are viruses in there. But if you look up the papers in which they produce these samples, there's no evidence whatsoever that they have a virus in there. They never demonstrated it. They're just claiming that on the label. And unfortunately, people around the world buy into this stuff. So
if you put a label on anything, people will believe it.
And then, of course, we have this terrible idea, not only that you can catch germs off other people, in a pandemic especially, but people walking around perfectly healthy could be asymptomatic and infectious, which is the worst of all worlds, right? Because a little 5-year-old girl dancing down the street could dance into Nana's place and kill her. That was the message. And of course, we're saying, where's the evidence for this being passed human to human? Where's the evidence for it being asymptomatic, even on your terms? And of course, we discover now there was none.
It's a giant cover story, the whole thing. And it ignores the real cause of disease as well, which is what I think is the worst part of it.
Yeah, and I think, Rodney, what was shocking for us in early 2020, and you know what you're talking about here with this alleged human-to-human transmission, is where in the scientific literature has this been demonstrated? Because we've looked at hundreds of these studies, and they've all failed. Like, you know, you'd think one of them would be enough to sink this whole thing, and people would say, oh my goodness, that's... they couldn't actually transmit influenza, or, you know, what they rely on is pseudoscience, basically, because we know that they tried this over and over again. We even know this with things like gonorrhea and syphilis. You know, Sam's made videos about this, of what they actually tried to do. It would be considered unethical these days, but, you know, applying people full of alcohol and getting them to have sex with other people to see if they could transmit these diseases. And they had no success doing this, which would shock people because they'd think, no, they're all highly infectious. But the same problem with things like chickenpox, measles, influenza, every time they've attempted to do natural exposure routes, so we're talking about bringing people into the same room, coughing on each other, coming into physical contact with each other, in extreme, you know, older studies dating back last century, sometimes having sexual intercourse with each other, they could not get any transmission of the disease through these natural routes. This is everything. Polio, all of them, they had the same problem. So what they ended up doing was these pseudoscientific procedures where, with things like chickenpox and measles, they would go find a sick kid and take a sample out of one of their skin lesions
With a needle,
and then inject it into a monkey or another human and cause a skin reaction and claim, there we go, that's evidence of contagious disease. And obviously that's ridiculous pseudoscience, injecting foreign proteins and other substances directly into another organism. That's not proof of contagion. It's certainly not a natural exposure route. And, you know, I don't think people understand that. It's the same with polio, which... you know, people were led to believe in the middle of last century that we were having all these outbreaks and that kids were passing it around. The basis of that was pseudoscientific experiments where they had a boy who had died of polio. They ground up his spinal cord and injected a huge amount of it into a couple of monkeys, which...
into their brains.
Straight into their brains, which would sometimes paralyze them and sometimes kill them. And then they told the world,
that's polio.
It, folks. We've found a virus and it's contagious. Now, I don't know about you, but I've never, ever come into contact with someone who said, I'm just going to drill a hole in your brain and inject some of my mucus directly into your head to establish that there's disease passing around. I mean, this is It's absolutely outrageous.
I'm sitting there listening to this and saying this can't be true.
I know.
And that's how you feel.
Well, you can't believe that this is the science behind it. Like, you think we were taught at medical school that this is all legitimate, this has all been proven, and we never looked at the original experiments.
We just thought,
well, this is what they're telling us, it must be right. And then when you go back and actually read it, I mean, you almost need to do it, because then you go, oh, this is unbelievable. And thankfully, I think we've had the ability to do it. This is what we try and do with our work, with our videos and things, is try and show people this is what they're saying is the science. This is what it's all based on. And the book is important because it outlines all of it's one part of it, but it's so massive, the ways that this has played out.
I think, Rodney, it's so bad that this is why it's being covered up. And can you imagine if they think that this is completely crazy, why don't the New Zealand media invite Sam and I onto live TV with Michael Baker and Susie Wiles, and we'll talk about the evidence behind this entire thing? I mean, if they think it's such a slam dunk, wouldn't they be confident that they could just make complete fools of us and everyone could see there's nothing to see there? But they don't. They won't go near this. They will not go near it. And as you know, that's why they just try and censor and cancel things, because...
Or discredit with,
Yeah.
So tell me this. This is what throws me, and explain this to me. I got sick, and it was like a bad hangover, shocking headache. I'd feel weak. Come right in the afternoon, stagger around, feeling a bit poorly. Next morning, bad again, about 3 days. I thought, this is interesting. And I got the test and stuck that thing up my nose, and it tested positive for COVID. It wasn't like any particular flu that I'd had before. But what was going on? What was I sick from, say, possibly? And what was the test doing? Because to me, I think, oh, well, yeah, I got COVID, right? Test positive. What do I know? I don't even know how that test works. So walk me through that.
Well, the test is funny because, Rodney, you could also drop some orange juice on the test. As we found out early on in the alleged pandemic, you could get positive tests from motor oil. You could test various animals. You could test inanimate objects, and they would also test quite positive. So that's probably the simplest way to point out to people that the test is bogus, because if you try those manoeuvres with a pregnancy test, you're unlikely to get a false result.
You're not going to get a pregnant orange, for example. It doesn't tend to work.
Whereas apparently you might have seen Tim's joke in the foreword. He talked about all the things that had returned positive tests, including inanimate objects, but reportedly they were all asymptomatic. So that was interesting. we get this question a lot, and people say, but the test was positive. So, we have actually written articles on how the test works and what it actually does. So the test, like if it was yours a PCR or a rapid antigen test?
Like a pregnancy test one.
Like a pregnancy test.
Okay.
Yes.
I haven't had one of those, but.
Yeah. So that's a lateral flow test, which is just searching for a protein, basically. Yeah. Now, where the whole thing's gone wrong with virology is that they say that protein that they're detecting comes from a virus. But we've been back through all of their coronavirus papers dating back to the 1980s when they said that they were first finding the alleged genome. And now none of those proteins have ever been shown to come from a virus. You do find them in tissue culture experiments. So you can get human samples or cow samples or chicken samples, and you can do various things in the lab and you'll detect those proteins. There's no doubt about it. They do seem to exist, but they don't come from a quote virus. So that's the first problem. It's not detecting a virus whatsoever. The other issue is that you know, we're big on the provenance of things, like proving where things comes from. So if you've got a protein you're detecting, you have to say, you have to be sure scientifically where that comes from. In the case of a pregnancy test, we know that it's beta HCG, which is this hormone that women produce. If they're pregnant, it goes to a very high level compared to their baseline, and the test will test positive. But in that case, we know, you know, where the hormone comes from and what its biological function is. With these tests, like the rapid antigen test, they're simply detecting these proteins that are the result of tissue breakdown. So it may be that, yeah, when you've got a runny nose or some tissue in your nasal passages that's breaking down, you will get presence of these proteins. As I say, nothing whatsoever to do with the virus. They're not, like, people seem to think that they were all tested and validated in clinical trials, etc. No, they're not. They're only validated to detect proteins, or in the case of PCR, genetic sequences. That's what they're validated to do. You know, there's we call that analytical sensitivity and specificity. They don't have clinical diagnostic abilities.
So I was just sick.
Yep.
Right. It could have tested positive. It could have tested negative, in which case I was sick but not COVID. Oh, I'm okay. I'm not going to die. And if I tested myself and I happened to be well and I tested positive, oh, I'm asymptomatic.
Yeah.
They can't lose, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They win both ways.
Yeah, totally. And I think too, we're not
only
saying,
when I test a watermelon and it's test positive, do I start to have questions.
Yeah.
And we're not saying there's no relationship between the PCR rapid antigen test and the presence of symptoms. That there may be. They may be able to show that. But there's no demonstration that a virus exists or that it relates to an infectious condition. That's that it can't possibly diagnose these things. And, you know, in the book, we walk through that and explain why, looking at the basic science, why you can't possibly diagnose this thing. The other thing we always say to people is, well, I mean, what you went through, Rodney, is what we call a healing crisis.
Yes.
Your body is trying to get back to being well. And it's this backwards way people have of looking at their body, where they think, oh my goodness, I feel terrible.
I'm sick. Rather than this is the beginning of healing that's going on.
Yeah, it should be embraced to say that I understand that I may have run myself down. Maybe I haven't looked after myself.
Maybe I've not been sleeping too well. Maybe I've had, got myself cold. Maybe I've had some alcohol, you know, too much to drink recently. Maybe the food's not been that great. There's a whole host, you know, literally hundreds or if not thousands of reasons why people get sick. And the experience of catarrh, of feeling run down, of having a fever, runny nose, cough, what have you, is the body's way of just trying to clear out those toxins. And that's the trouble, is it's such a common experience, these symptoms. And all they've done is equated that with COVID-19. That's, to me, is the biggest crime of it all, is people say, I had COVID-19. What is COVID-19?
Yeah, that's what we run through in the book in the section Meaningless Cases, because the official definition of a confirmed case is simply one of those molecular tests, whether it's PCR or rapid antigen.
And you do this great section about, you know, how Tom Hanks was in Australia and he got COVID and yada yada yada, and Boris Johnson got COVID, and he was actually, that was a great story, because I had a huge argument with a former friend because he got sick of arguing with me, and he's, oh well, you know, how do you explain Boris Johnson, you know, damn near killed him. And that's how our mind works, right? Because my friend was convinced Boris Johnson had COVID because he tested positive and he was very sick. But there are a lot of reasons for Boris Johnson to be sick.
Okay.
Well, we had that too, Rodney, in 2020, when we don't have many medical colleagues left because they won't speak to us. They're too scared of what we say. And, you know, we had that too in early 2020. Like, we'd talk to people and say, look, this COVID thing seems a bit odd, doesn't it? Things seem to be overblown. And we'd honestly talked to very intelligent doctors, you know, physicians and surgeons, etc., who would say, "Oh, look, we've heard there's a surgeon and you know, in England, he was 54 years old. He's dead of COVID now, and this is serious." And we'd just say, we'd think these are doctors, and we'd say, "So, did you review the clinical records?" "No." "So, what did he have, past medical history?" "Or, oh, we don't know." "Do you know anything about him apart from that he died when he was 54? "No, but, you know, they say that he tested for COVID and he's dead of COVID." And we said, "Yeah, but as doctors, it's always our job to examine every fact that we can get our hands on. You know, we want to know, what were the circumstances of this guy's death? You know, what was his background? What did the autopsy show, etc.?" Not, "Oh, yeah, I've heard that he had COVID and he's dead and now we all have to get scared." But this was honestly the thinking going on. And I even had one conversation with a doctor when I just said to him, you know, he was talking about the pandemic and stuff. And I said, "Well, what's the definition of a case?" And he said, "Oh, I don't really know." He said, "That's not my job." And this is where we were at. The conversation couldn't progress because the supposedly highly educated doctor couldn't even tell me what the case definition of COVID was.
And then I got that amazing thing when I researched into it, that once you declare something a pandemic and they're reportable, then literally in one case you could get shot in the driveway by the cops or something, and but you died with COVID. You were a COVID case, because if it was suspected, it's just written on the death certificate.
Yeah.
And so it automatically exaggerates the numbers. One of my friend's parents was 93 and died in the so-called Christchurch cluster. And they had severe dementia.
Yes.
They hadn't been able to recognise any of the members of their family for 6 years. They were living totally on borrowed time. It was very sad for them when their parent died. But in a way, they were relieved, as you can often be in such situations. It was a front page story.
I know.
It was a calamity.
Do you know, Rodney, when that happened, we had a colleague that we knew, a nurse that was working at the dementia unit, because I remember going, you're trying to find on the ground what's happening real time.
Yeah.
And it said, these are all end-stage dementia patients.
Yes.
I thought, oh, my goodness, this is what they're doing, is just reclassifying deaths. And they did this, you know, this was everywhere. We knew I think the very first case of that happened on the west coast of New Zealand when the outbreak happened was again someone
that's right.
That was incredibly really sick.
Tell me just quickly, because I'm talking to Dr. Sam and Mark Bailey. I feel bad because I've got so into this book and into this couple that and the conversation, I've not reminded everyone that I'm talking to Sam and Mark Bailey, two doctors. Wonderful couple and wonderful mums and dads, mum and dad. And for our today is this wonderful book, The Final Pandemic, which you can get on Amazon and Lulu, and you can see at drsambailey.com, if I got that right, and you can see their work and their videos, which are a treasure trove available to everyone. We have this odd thing, don't we, where Sean Plunkett calls Steve Kirsch a cooker, which I love that phrase. I'd never heard of it before, but he's a cooker, which is kooky or something, right? So Steve Kirsch is kooky because he thinks the vaccine is damaging people. And Steve Kirsch is, I'm picking on him because you mentioned him. But this is part of the interest. So Steve Kirsch is being demonized all over social media, and Sean Plunkett's calling him a cooker, and he's wanting to debate Sean Plunkett and offering money to a debate and all the rest of it. But then Steve Kirsch will think you're cookers, right? Because you're saying, well, hang on. What even makes you think, Steve, that there was a disease called COVID? Right. So he thinks, if you like, that there's this huge error occurred around the vaccine and is now being covered up. But it's kooky to say hang on, what is the basis for this disease? Isn't that weird to you? Like, I'm not picking on Steve. I'm just saying it's this layers of the onion, isn't it? Like, you start peeling it back, and he's never peeled back. He's saying to everyone, well, just look at what I've got, look at what I've got. And you're saying to Steve, look at what we've got. And it's like, just look at it. Not hard.
I know.
Look at it.
It's like looking at the cave, you know, the
Plato's cave.
The fire on the wall, and you feel like, look outside.
It is. Plato's cave is a perfect analogy, right? And you go out of the cave and you realize you're just watching shadows. And that behind the men that were making the shadows, you come out at night and there's all the stars. And then it becomes daylight and there's a whole world. And you were just watching shadows on a cave. It's a wonderful analogy to it. And yet Steve is seeing the men moving the shadows on the wall of the cave. And you're saying, well, just go, like, question it. The Royal Society, question everything.
I think Rodney, you know, gives Steve another year or two and he might get there, because we've watched the evolution of Steve. And it's funny because people think that he was onto it from the start and no.
No, he's vexed, right?
Yeah.
He is. And unfortunately, his children, he double vexed as well. So he was quite late to wake up to what was going on. And yeah, we have in our email inbox, we have a few crazy emails from Steve Kirsch wanting to have $1 million bets, etc. And we don't take Steve too seriously on that matter, because, you know, his audience knows too. He doesn't know virology. I think he wrote a couple of smear articles about us because his audience were pressing him. And then he surveyed his own audience, and what stunned him was, I think 50 or 60% of his own audience said it was doubtful that viruses existed, or they thought they didn't exist. So he was shocked, basically, because I think he thought that 99% of people were going to bag us. But he got quite a lot of backlash after his couple of smear articles. Yeah. And he's actually left it alone, as far as I know, for more than a year, maybe a year and a half. He hasn't made any comments about virology.
But you always leave the door open.
Right. Well, you're a wonderful couple. And I have to say, I was worried about interviewing two people at once, because I find interviewing quite hard, knowing when to ask a question and when to shut up. And I thought, two people, but it's great, you're husband and wife, and you just work in together so well. So thank you for that. Unfortunately, we haven't covered a fraction of the book. I thought in the time we had, we'd get through it. But it's an amazing book. And all I can do is ask people to buy it and read it and pass it on, because it's wonderful. And I think the thing that you can tell when you're talking to Sam and to Mark and this interview, they're not raving lunatics, right? They're people who have taken the time to look, and not look just one level, but to go back to the original papers that get quoted and then quoted and then get quoted. And along the way, a transcription error occurs for one reason or another, and a myth gets built of what was being done. And I was falling for the myth of Koch's postulates. He didn't do it. Time and time again, we find this in science, actually, in different fields, that it's just built on a summary, a misinterpretation. And you have done an amazing piece of work, the two of you. But I particularly commend you for the patience that you have and the gentle way you explain yourselves and the results of your research, because it must get frustrating.
Yeah, it is. But I still feel, Rodney, that my dream is that all I hope for what our work brings is that it reduces people's fear, because I think fear is one of the massive drivers.
That will make you sick.
Yes. And if that helps someone, if they go, okay, I'm not gonna feel fearful of microbes anymore, then I feel like job done. That's great.
Job done. And they're not just scared of microbes, scared of the neighbors. Okay, that is Dr. Sam Bailey, Dr. Mark Bailey, two doctors, two wonderful human beings, two great books that I've read, Virus Mania. Read this one first, The Final Pandemic. And wouldn't it be wonderful if it was the final pandemic? I got a feeling, like my friend way back in 1992, that this might have legs, this mania. But you'll read that book and you'll want to read Virus Mania. We're truly blessed to have them amongst us here in New Zealand. You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Send me a text, 2057. Email me at inbox@realitycheck.radio. Thank you so much for listening. And again, amazing how blessed we are. These are two amazing people on the world stage, and they're here in New Zealand. We're very lucky indeed to have them on our show.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day in life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.